Thanks to a sweet finish from Solly March, Albion were finally set for victory in Gwent last night, only for Newport to steal an equaliser after a goalkeeping gaffe, and thanks to Lee Mason seemingly borrowing Chris Kavanagh's watch from the Manchester United league game. Yes, Phantom added on time on top of the real added on time allowed us to allow them back into it, allowing us to burn another half hour's energy on the bobbly Rodney Parade pitch. But it all worked out in the end, that as the Albion goalie showed nerves of steel to outwit the Exiles' penalty takers and save the blushes of Messrs. Morps, Biss and Trossard. We also witnessed the debut of South Africa's finest, Percy Tau, coming off the bench to play his part, and saw an Albion fan sitting in a tree in true FA Cup style. One man for whom it would be a gross understatement to say played his part during his time with the Albion is Brian Horton, and it is our very great pleasure and delight to say that the Albion's former Captain Marvel and genuine club legend has agreed to join us for a chat this afternoon, this Monday, I should say. Welcome to the podcast, Brian. How are you?
Good afternoon. Yeah, keeping well.
Excellent.
Football's keeping me going. That one kept me going last night, kept the nerves going. So, I'm good. Thank you.
It kept us going far too long, in fact, didn't it? extra time and penalties, always nice and relaxing.
Well, I just saw them score the goal and I thought that was it. I went out for something, came back in and saw the ball going in the net for the equaliser. Couldn't believe it.
It's tragic, isn't it? You just knew it was going to go that way as well. The fact that the worst case scenario was just to have a long drawn out match with two games coming up in the next in this coming week. Just typical, isn't it? But I have to ask you, first of all, Brian, have you ever scaled a tree to watch a football match?
No, I've probably scaled the trees on Oak Park to try and get out of training.
That's fair enough. Footballers generally are known to not particularly like training, are they? Or at least all the fitness side of it.
Yeah. I love training, but that's where we used to train, believe it or not. Oak Park and out the trees. Or at the greyhound track, amazing for where we took the football club and we were training on places like that. It was quite bizarre.
Yeah.
Brian, did you live near Hove Park?
Yeah, I lived in Hove Park. Mark Lawrence and lived close. We used to walk the dogs in the morning before we went to the Goulston.
One of my early childhood memories. I used to play for a team called Hove Park Colts. And we used to train at Hove Park on a Friday evening. And I remember seeing you. I can't remember if I saw Lawrence. I'm sure Wardy was there at some point as well. You had a ridiculously large dog walking your dogs around Hove Park. We used to stop our game just to watch you go past.
Well, I actually bought it when it was off.
I think Brian might have frozen.
Gelfond, and when he got transferred to Notts Forest, I asked Mr. Bamber if I could. Sorry. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now. Yes, yeah. Froze up there for a moment. Yeah. Sorry, say again. So you were asking Mr. Bamber something.
I was asking Mr. Bamber if I could buy the house off him because Wardy had obviously got to Notts Forest, and that's what I did. So I moved into Peter Ward's place on Oak Park.
All right, fantastic. Brilliant. We should mention the voice you heard just a moment ago was Andy. Andy Bravery is with us as usual, and Peter and I. We would actually just probably at this stage just ask you what you've been doing actually, Brian, because we've been busy doing podcasts and some work as well. What have you been doing in recent times and how have you found the lockdown period? Because it's strange times indeed, isn't it, at the moment?
It is. I was lucky to get the Man City Newcastle game to go on Radio Manchester to do the live game from the Etihad. So that was good. I got my house and doing, and I'm doing the Crystal Palace game next weekend. So that's given me something to do. Obviously, the podcasts and this stuff, all the Zooms have kept me going. Publisher said I needed to do that to promote the book, which is, it's a shame, really, that the book came out when this was all on, because obviously I can't come to Brighton and do a book signing or go to Hull and do one, or even go into Man City Football Club and do one. So it's been a bit of a shame. So this has kept me going, basically. It's been good to do, and meeting you guys and you know, bringing back great memories. It's been good.
Oh, great. Well, we're glad you're enjoying them, and glad you, well, hopefully you'll enjoy this one as well. One thing you have been doing as well is watching the Albion, haven't you? And the aforementioned game that took place last night, that left us all entirely relaxed, up in Newport, extra time penalties. What did you make of the game? What did you think?
Well, I went to Newport with Swindon when Phil Brown and I were at Swindon a couple of seasons back, and the pitch was exactly the same then, and it's that they have had major problems because they have rugby on it. So I knew it was never going to be a good pitch, and the way Graham Potter wants to play and play out from the back and everything, I knew it was going to be tough to be able to do that. They tried to do it, obviously, and did it quite well. But Newport are a decent team. They've had some good scalps over the last few years. Manager Mike Flynn's done a fantastic job there. So I knew it wasn't going to be easy, but I fancied Brighton to win it. But I didn't think it'd go to extra time, and obviously it did. And then the penalties, and gosh, it was everybody's missing them, weren't they? I know I missed a couple, you know, in my days. But obviously, you know, when it's like, I've never been in one of those where it's so dramatic, you know, where the keeper's saving it, people reaching the post, and it was a dramatic penalty shootout.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I think it was given to Bissouma, the man of the match award, apart from the fact I always think that's given slightly too early in games anyway. It was made to look all the more ridiculous by the fact it then went to extra time and there was a whole huge chunk of the match still to be played. But I did think possibly there's an argument for the Newport goalie prior to that, certainly after it was awarded, because he made another cracking save from Lewis Dunk late in the game. And then obviously you could argue for Jason Steele as well, saving four penalties in the shootout, which we eventually won the hard way, as we did the rest of the game. Just to bring the other guys in on this one, so Peter and Andy, I mean, first of all, Peter, what did you make of the game? Highs and lows? Any positives to take?
I found myself weirdly relaxed, even during the penalties, to be honest. I began to think it would be so typical of Albion to get to the bloody FA Cup final this season that I was almost thinking that if we got knocked out, at least we wouldn't have the possibility of going to an FA Cup final in lockdown year when we couldn't, you know, only the second time in our history. And for context, I was only one win the last time, so I couldn't actually have, I couldn't go, obviously. So to miss it because of, you know, or to have a half full Wembley even or whatever would be typical. But obviously I was glad we won in the end. I mean, I think... It was a very typical Albion game. We had possession. We didn't really do an awful lot with it. We had forced the keeper into a couple of saves, made a silly error. I mean, I'm still not sure, having seen it so many times, what Steele was doing. I mean, he should have caught that rather than punching. So why he chose to punch it, I don't know. I mean, it was quite an easy catch, I would have said. But then, yeah, fair play to him. He then stepped up in the shootout and, yeah, did pretty well there. Can't really argue with four saves out of seven, made up for it. And, yeah, the number of penalties were pretty dreadful. I know Andy and I were having a discussion about Trossard yesterday, and obviously he didn't have a great game, and his penalty was awful. I do agree with you there. I mean, he was pretty poor yesterday. It was my comments were more aimed at it being generally, I think he's done, you know, he's the one who kind of makes us a better team when he plays well. But yeah, yesterday, none of the attack really played that well, and no one really did that brilliantly, except obviously it was a really good goal from March.
Yeah, Andy?
Yeah, I mean, when you looked at the pitch, you thought, you know, I was kind of hoping that Potter might have mixed it up a little bit and played a little bit longer down the channels a bit and gained more pay and secure a bit of a chance to run down. But, you know, we didn't. So we tried to play our game, which was always going to be difficult. You know, we were obviously going to get some chances, but were we going to take them? Their goalkeeper decided to have a really good game, actually. It was one of those where you thought he might have actually won the game for them in the end. I thought that, and I didn't think Steele was having too bad a game. There was a point when he had to head the ball when I don't think he couldn't catch it. I don't think he really knew quite what to do, but we got away with it. He made a few good saves, and then, you know, he just has an aberration, doesn't he, for that. He basically, his decision-making was really poor for the cross. And Trossard just last night, I just shook my head in despair. He didn't look like he wanted to be there. I don't know from whether there's something going for him off the field, but he didn't look. And when he went up for the penalty, I just shook my head. I was hoping that the fifth penalty was going to be taken by Prupper, because I thought like he would really, you know, he'll finish it off. And then obviously it's Trossard, and then we're under more pressure again.
Earlier, because he took a really good one at Millwall in the cup a couple of years ago when we got to the semi-finals. I was surprised he wasn't in the first five.
Yeah. I thought once again, Solly March had a, you know, another good game, great goal. And like I said before, I think that, you know, Potter this season playing him at wing back has kind of rescued his Premiership career, Premier League career, because I thought he was looking like he might drop down to the Championship. But, you know, along with Bissouma, been our best two players all season, really. You know, And I thought Webster looked good again.
Yeah, he was very unlucky with the own goal. Nothing you could have done about that.
Nothing at all, no.
And he finally finished the game off as well after our about
took the penalty.
Attempt to do it.
A very cool penalty. Very cool penalty for centre-half.
It's an interesting
class.
Centre-half took really good penalties. And yes, our strikers got missed that were really poor.
It's classic Albion, isn't it? We have to do things the hard way as well. Having said that, another typical feature is we do tend to do quite well in penalty shootouts, in terms of the outcome at least. There's the Swindon playoff, there's Man City in the League Cup. Luton was the aberration in the one of Brian's former teams.
One at Luton, which was horrendous.
Yeah, that was terrible.
But the last 10 or something like that?
Yeah, because Shrewsbury, I think, was the same year as Luton, wasn't it? Yeah. In the same competition. We've obviously had Millwall, that you mentioned, a couple of years ago. So generally do okay, but I did feel unconfident with the penalty shootout because I thought we'd probably overdue a defeat in one of them. But thankfully, we managed to make it through.
It's always the next round.
It should have been a glorious winner for Solly, shouldn't it? Because he scored so much later than we wanted, but us to score. But it was a good goal, nicely taken, wasn't it? Talk us through that one, somebody. Peter, what did you think of that?
Yeah, it's really well worked. Nicely worked out to the wing and played across the proper. And yeah, it was quite the interchange between the two of them, where he kind of like March got to get off his feet, was quite clever and kind of, I think, wrong footed a couple of the defenders. And then, yeah, it was really well taken. He put it round, curled it round the defender. I don't know why I'm moving my hand to show that, because I don't want to do that. But yeah, curled around and it was really well taken. Nothing the keeper could do. I don't think he could even seen it really, because there were probably people in his way. So yeah, and you kind of assume at that point, 91 minutes or whatever it is, that's game over. And then yeah, it's typical Albion that it wouldn't be.
Yeah, and the referees do, as I mentioned it earlier, the referees do seem to like adding extra time on top of the extra time on top of the extra time. You know, they give you the stoppage time and it rarely goes too much more than what they say, does it? I know it's the minimum of and all that, but it's usually what, maybe a maximum of 30 seconds added on. I think there was one, maybe two subs at the same time in the stoppage time. But he added on, I think it was something like a minute and 20 seconds, was it, or something, when we conceded the goal. Oh, so annoying, isn't it? I mean, I don't know, Brian, did you see the earlier game in the season, the Man United match, which had just about everything? We hit the crossbar a record number of times since Opta Stats began for the top flight, 5 times. There was a penalty decision that wasn't clear and obvious that was overturned by VAR. And then United scoring that goal was a penalty, but it was after the final whistle. But it was also after the final whistle should have gone.
Yeah.
Did you catch that one?
Yeah, watch the game. You never know what they're going to do, do you? I mean, last night they did bring Proctor and the other guy on a bit later on, so I think and that was about right. But when they scored, concentration level, what happened to allow that to happen? I know Steele could have done better with a cross, but he redeemed himself obviously with the penalties. I agree with Solly Marsh. I thought was very, very good. Great goal. He's doing well in that left wing back position. I thought Dunk was outstanding. And you need your big, strong players, physical players on pitches like that, where you know it's going to be physical. It's not going to be a pretty game. I thought Dunk was excellent.
Yeah, he had a couple of chances as well, didn't he?
From him, well, not quite goal line, but going back and kicking off the line at some point, wasn't there?
Yeah, I think I'm surprised he didn't get concussed from one. He blocked with his head inadvertently as well.
And he also had two of our better chances as well, forced the keeper into two of the better saves of the night.
Yeah, I think the save that the keeper made low down from Zakiri, which was really unlucky from his point of view, because it was a brilliant save, not only in getting down to it, but the trajectory he got the ball away at was great. But the save from Dunk, yeah, I think that was a brilliant header. He got really good lift onto the and power onto that header. And the goalie, I thought, was beaten there. And suddenly, you're looking at the ball going in a wrong direction. But yeah, you're right, Brian. I think Dunk's got back to his best, I think, now. He's looking really dangerous at the other end as well. That's got to be a promising sign for us going forward. And Percy Tau made his debut, as we mentioned. Although he didn't score any goals and he didn't actually take a penalty, didn't get to that stage. Again, someone else I might have liked to have seen before Trossard in the in the lineups for penalties. But he looked quite lively as well. I don't know, guys, what you thought of him. Some good interplay, some good creativity, maybe.
Well, I'll say there, he had a couple of off chances, didn't he, when he came on? But you know, you can't make players take a penalty if they don't fancy it, and you know, it's a tricky situation. I've known players. Yeah. No, not for me, thank you. And it's you know, you think a professional footballer would like to take a penalty. I always did, and we used to share them. Me and Ward, if he missed one, I was on it, and vice versa. And you've got to fancy them, and you can't tell people how to take penalties. I had this issue with Alan Muller when he first came, when he said, "I want you to blast them," and I said, "I don't blast them, and you can't tell me what to do on a penalty. I need to just do it my way." So I just blasted the one against Crystal Palace when we beat him 3-0 on Boxing Day, and just blasted it down the middle. So at least that one pleased him.
Well, that pleased everyone, I'm sure. I mean, penalties is a funny thing, isn't it? I think you're right. You can't... you've got to be in your comfort zone. It's such a key mental moment in the game, isn't it? You have to be at ease and confident. And really, you just want to make it as formulaic as possible. You'd step up, hit it. You don't want to overthink it, do you, I suppose? Would that be true for you, Brian, would you say, from your career?
Well, yeah. And again, I'd be watching, if I was, say, again, taking a penalty last night, not knowing maybe if it's going to be a penalty shootout, but if I got a penalty, I'd recognise their keeper, either right-handed, left-handed. Which way do they prefer to go? If you're right-handed, you generally want to go that way. So I would take all these things in. You know, today they studied and have the goalkeeping coach that would have told him where their penalty takers mainly take the penalties. They're up to all that kind of issue. But it is one that if you're a player that don't fancy them, then you can't change his mind. It's one of those things that you can't force people to do, you know. But obviously they've gone on and on, so they're going to have to take a penalty, aren't they? You know, and it gets down to the keepers where it's happened. I agree with you, their keeper last night was absolutely fantastic, brilliant, and so was Steele in the penalty shootout. I agree with what you said earlier on about man of the match before we play extra time. I don't get that, you know. I don't get that at all.
They do it with 5 minutes left or so. And, you know, that time, it's always typical that someone will make a mistake if they've been given man the match or something.
Yeah. Yeah, and they often, obviously, with this crowds there, they normally announce it in the stadium as well, although that might be the club one. But nonetheless, it seems to be a bit unnecessary.
The official one that the club do, that the sponsors do, is so random anyway. It doesn't really matter when it's announced. They might as well announce it at kickoff, to be honest, given the...
Because then they're just picking who they want to meet, aren't they?
Definitely, yes.
Yeah, which you'd like to think is likely to be the man of the match, or one of the, because the man of the match is likely to be one of the star players, I guess you might say. But anyway, there we go. But we got there in the end. We got the results. That's us happy. A really difficult fixture to negotiate, I think. And as Peter and I have said before, we like to tick off the grounds. We've done most of them, Brian, of the current 92, but neither of us have been to Newport. So it's incredibly frustrating that years and years I've been waiting for that and other draws to come up. It's typical it's come up this year when we couldn't be there. Or none of us, apart from that Albion fan in the tree, of course. But I'm assuming he's a local.
92 if you're in a tree outside the ground.
Yeah, no, you can't count it if you're outside, can you? that'll do for the Newport game. Other than to say that does mean we are now in both fourth and the fifth round draws because they're both taking place tonight. We're recording this Monday afternoon. It's taking place Monday evening. This is obviously a logistics thing, isn't it? To know where we're at and what the full pattern of the future's planned out. For those that do get through the fourth round, they'll know where they're going to be. And I guess it's good to get plans in place as soon as possible. That's got to be particularly brilliant for Chorley, isn't it? I think that's going to be fantastic for them to... also agonising in a way, probably. If they get something like Burnley away or something like that, and then they find out the next game will be City at home or Liverpool, that might be a bit of a gutter.
Yeah. I wonder if it'll affect our thinking as well. If we say, for example, to get a more winnable fourth round tie, but then get like Man U or Liverpool away in round five, yeah, then we're probably not going to go through anyway. Do we then play the reserves and, you know, even mess with reserves with Fulham coming up the midweek after?
That's a good point. Yeah.
I wouldn't have liked that as a player, that you know you're going to play somebody that you think might be an easy game, so you'll rest me. I wouldn't have liked that. I don't know many players in my in my career that would have said, oh, let's rotate and play him there and not play him there and play. I wanted to play every game that was there. If I can't play Saturday, Tuesday, Saturday, then there's something wrong, in my opinion. You know, the game has got probably faster and stuff like that, but I wouldn't want to be a rotated player.
Yeah, Brian, can I just ask on that?
I just wanted to ask on that, Brian, because, I mean, obviously never at your level, but even when I played, I like to be in a rhythm, and I got a rhythm from playing every week. Stop, start. I would have found it hard just to come in for the occasional game, you know, for a game and then maybe play two and then have a rest. I would never have appreciated that.
No.
I just wanted to play football. Would that have been your view back then?
Well, this good story, really, because I got suspended whilst I was playing for Brighton later on in the season, and I missed the Leighton Orient game away. So we used to travel as a squad. So obviously we've gone to Leighton Orient as a squad and all the players are not playing. I think there's only probably one or two subs then, maybe one. And the gaffer made us go. We sat with the fans over in a far corner at Leighton Orient, and they drew 3-3, or we drew 3-3. And I thought he'd bring me back, being captain. And he sat me on the bench, Charlton at home. And I was absolutely furious. Anyway, we went in about 3-0, and he said to me, go on then, have a good, because probably see how sulking and got a face on. And he said, go on then, see if you can score one, make one. I went on, made one, we won 4-0. And then the next game, he brings me back. So I said to Ken Craggs, the gaffer wouldn't have, you know, question him. It's not really the likes of question. But I said to Ken Craggs, who's number two, I said, Ken, what's all that about? He left me, he didn't bring me back after you've drawn 3-3, or we've drawn 3-3, sorry. And now he brings me back after we've won 4-0. What's that? And he said, he just wanted to let you know that you weren't irreplaceable. And it's good management, isn't it? You know, it just kept you down, basically, to make sure that you knew where you were. Good management. So, but I hated just missing that one game. I want to get back and playing as quickly as I can, you know.
Yeah, somebody said on the BBC game, the Marine Spurs match, I can't remember who it was on the commentary, said, oh, he's got his hat-trick in the first half for this year, wasn't it? He'll probably be OK with being taken off. And I think at the time, I thought, surely not. And then whoever it was got called up on it, didn't they, straight away?
He wouldn't have liked it, right. By the way. Then Alan Shearer's, obviously, he's the same as the striker. he bid straight away, didn't he? Went, well, come off after scoring 3-1, or 4, or 5, or 6. You know?
And he's got visions of a double hat trick in his head, I'm sure, at that point.
He's not played 30 games either, so surely he wants to have a full 90.
Exactly. All the more so if he's a reserve effectively at the moment. But crazy stuff. There we go. Anyway, we're at least into the fourth round. We'll see if we get further. It would be good to go on a nice cup run, but only if it's not.
The Southampton game against Shrewsbury that hasn't been played yet, and the West Ham Stockport game get each other. So when they're talking about the fifth round draw, they've got four options.
That's going to get messy, isn't it?
Probably 5 miles from Stockport, and I would have probably gone to that game, but obviously you can't go. One of my best mates is a season ticket holder there with his mum, and they can't go. It's just such a shame, but be a good game for TV. And obviously, as you're saying there, all the draws done before, so it's going to be a chaotic draw, isn't it? Who do you play, and then who do you play if you win?
And having a really good season, Stockport as well. I think they're like in the top six or something, aren't they, in the National League?
Yeah, he's got a good side. He's got a good side together. Rooney's relation, playing his brother, I think. And he's got some good players. And he's probably got a good budget because the new owner, who's a massive Man City fan, he's took over the football club and pumped up quite a bit of money in there. So they need to get back in the league. It's a shame, really, because the ground's good. The training, I believe, at Man City's ex-training ground at Carrington. So the whole structure of the football club is geared to get him back in the league.
It's not like they were in a championship, 20 years ago, something like that, they were in a championship or something?
Beat Man City. It's a place that I used to hate playing at. You know, you have some of these grounds where you never like playing. I could never win there. And you have that as a player or as a manager or a team where you think, cool, we don't fancy them there, never do very well there. But it's a good setup and it'll be a good game again. They'll give West Ham a game tonight.
Would you ever analyse why you might not like playing somewhere, or would it just be a feeling that you'd have?
Well, Jose Mourinho said it before the game, didn't he? He said, I won't take the blame tonight. If we lose at Marine, it's their fault. not mine. I've told them, you know, they know the, what the pitch is like, and I thought they were very professional. And this is what you need to be. It's no good thinking, oh, we'll win easy here tonight, and, you know, it's horrible being in the dressing rooms are awful, and it's cold, and it's wet, and it's raining, and no crowd. And so their attitude was spot on, wasn't it? I mean, they went very quickly.
I mean, things like a lot of the quality is to do with things like speed of thought and intelligence within the game, isn't it? And if you are being more relaxed, you're probably slowing down those processes, I would imagine. And that's what maybe an element that levels it up a bit as well, perhaps. Is that part of what? Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, some of these boys at Stockport have been in the league, so they're no mugs, you know. It's a good level that they're playing at with the conference, so they'll have to be on the toes tonight with West Ham.
Yeah, well, when we went to Stockport with the missus, it was an evening game away, and it's Edgeley Park, isn't it, the ground, I think?
Yes, yeah.
And it was a goalless draw, so you're right, we didn't get a result either when we went there. I did also see them at Wembley. I see they do get a decent crowd. They played a playoff against Rochdale. I've got a feeling Liam Dickinson, one of our former players, was playing in that game.
He was there, yeah.
Yeah, and I went down just to tick Wembley off, actually, and my mate is a Brighton fan living in Rochdale, so we went in the Rochdale end, and it was quite a decent turnout from Stockport, I have to say. They had far more fans there, and they're a decent-sized club. They had Jim Gannon doing well for them, and when he left, I think, I'm not sure exactly how related it is, but things have gone downhill, and he's come back.
They had some financial issues as well, didn't they? They sold half their squad to Albion at one point.
Yeah, that's right. And we tried to get the manager, didn't we? We tried to get him at one point, and he turned us down, I think.
Nolte came to us. He was there, I think. Dickinson went to us by a derby. There was quite a few Stockport players who then went on to play for Albion.
Yeah, and he's doing well for them again, Jim Gannon, so it's all good. But, yeah. So with regard to your career then, really, and I was going to come to that in a moment, Brian, but first of all, just to sort of talk us through how things all started. So you whereabouts were you? You're from whereabouts originally, and what was life like growing up as what was your childhood like?
I was born in Ensford, and 1949, I'm 72 in February, I can't believe it. But my dad's a miner. He people tell me he was a very good footballer, and people used to say he was better than ever I was. And I used to go, well, who did he play for and everything? But he loved football, and he was a massive Wolves fan. So I became a massive Wolves fan from probably the age of 5, 6, where he used to take me, put me on the wall behind the goal, and then collect me after the game. And they were the best side in England then, by the way. And, you know, they were winning cups and leagues and stuff. And Ron Flowers was my favourite player, my hero. And they were great days. When they're playing for the school team, for the county, when I was 15, for Staffordshire and then Birmingham District, didn't quite make the England 11. Some of my players that I played with at that level did. And then I went to Worcester as an apprentice when I was 15.
Yeah, excellent. And Wolves would have been the most local team, wouldn't it, in terms of professional status for you, would that be right? I'm not sure of the geography.
Well, we were very lucky, really, because we had Wolves are obviously in the top division, Villa, West Brom, Birmingham. So if Villa if Wolves were away, we would then choose the next best game. Right. And it's from where I live. There was a bus going to every game. So we would say then West Brom would play in Tottenham, we would go to that game. And so we had great choice of football. It was the Midlands was a fantastic football place at that time. You know, all the sides were in the top league. But Wolves was obviously the team that I wanted to win all the time. And it was funny, really, because during my Brighton career, where we played more than I played at other places, probably might have played against them was at Luton. But we could never lose to them. We used to beat them all the time. And it was funny. And I turned when I left Luton to go to Hull, I had the opportunity to go to Brighton to Wolves as player coach, and I turned it down to become manager of Hull City. And it's not a regret, because my career went on, you know, to do what I did as a manager. But I always wanted to play for Wolves, and it was a massive, massive decision that I had to make, and I chose to go to Hull City to be the manager.
Yeah. When you were growing up, I mean, who were your main influences in those formative years in terms of, you mentioned, you know, the Wolves days, was it, presumably it was those players that with a big influence on you in a footballing sense and that kind of thing?
The biggest influence was a guy called Ron Bullis, who was a teacher at another school. And he ran a team called Cannock Athletic in the Walsall Junior Youth League that was under 18s. And he used to take me and two or three other guys, lads, training in the week and do ball skills and stuff like that we'd never, ever done before. And I was actually playing for the under 18 team when I was 11, won the league. And he was the major influence on me from, say, 11 to 15.
Yeah, excellent. And so you did your sort of the hard yards, I suppose you could call them, in football, but maybe less well known to Albion fans than the later times with the bigger clubs. But you started, is it right, you started with Walsall, got released and then ended up at Hensford for your first years as a player. Is that right?
Yeah, I was 15 when I went to, left school at 15 in those days. So 15 to 17 was the apprenticeship, and they could extend it to 3 if they wanted to, or sign you pro at 17, or if they've left it for a year, sign you pro at 18. And I thought I'd done okay. I'd broke into the reserve side when I was 17 in my second season, and I thought I'd done okay. And for whatever reason, they chose to not renew my contract, and so I got a free transfer at 17. I had to get 3 buses home to Hensford where I lived. Broke my heart, probably crying all the way home, thinking my world's ended, and it was. But you know, I went to Hensford to play for them. Dick Neil, who'd been a player himself, he was the manager. He took me in 17. I went work on the building, which I really, really enjoyed. I was very small when I was 15, to say 17, probably 5'5". And sort of going on a building, it helped me grow up as a person. It helped me grow up physically. And my days at Hensford were fantastic. I had 4 great years, and we were a good team, full of ex-pros. And we won the Staffordshire Senior Cup, which was my very last game before I went to Port Vale. And I thoroughly enjoyed those 4 years working on the building and playing for Hensford. And I had to take, would you believe, I had to take a drop, a big drop in wages to go back to Port Vale at 21. I was earning more money on the building and playing for Hensford than I was when I went back to Port Vale. But I wanted to be a footballer again, and I took the chance, and it obviously worked.
I think that's great that you really, really do see this, the worth in that time of who really wanted to be a footballer. You know, you had to really push for it, didn't you, by the sounds of it, to be taking a wage cut to, or an overall wage cut to play the game you love. That's the true testament, isn't it? Which is, it's great. And then you, so Port Vale was the first pro club. That was 1970, wasn't it? According to Wikipedia, it is anyway.
70. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they just got promotion from the 4th to the 3rd as I joined. I played one reserve game at the start of the season and then got broke into the team and never played another reserve game all my career. To player manager also. Yeah, so it started, we had some good players. A lot of players that come like me from non-league, free transfers from other clubs, and the club had very little money. But we had a fantastic team spirit. Nobody wanted to play us. We were physical, we were strong. And it was again, great times, you know, great team spirit, great times. And I had great years there.
I think it's the most games you played, wasn't it, at Port Vale? I think just by a short head, I think. Is that right? Just under 250 somewhere?
Yeah, just a few more, I think, that I played for the Albion, yeah.
So that's brilliant. So 6 years, I think, with Vale, by the looks of it here, and then another 5 years with the Albion, which was 76 to 81. This is, of course, the stuff that our listeners will be most interested to hear about. How did it come about, first of all, the transfer? And as I understand it, I think if my timelines are correct, Peter Taylor signed you, but wasn't there for very long. Is that right?
That's right. We played Crystal Palace on a Tuesday night, and it was Thursday was deadline day for the transfers, March, and we're playing Crystal Palace. We for once in the season, we were right up there with the Brighton, with Millwall, with Palace for going for a promotion. Playoffs weren't in those days, and I scored. We drew 2-2. Absolutely elated. We've got a good result at Palace. We came in the dressing room. And Roy Sproston, who was the manager I'd played with as well, and then Roy took over. He died recently, God bless him, great guy. And he came to me straight away and he said, Brian, we've sold you today. We've agreed a fee with Brighton for £30,000 and you've got to go down for talks. And I was the only one that didn't know, by the way. Apparently all the players knew on the way down, but never couldn't say anything, the fact that I was going. So we played the game. And it's crazy. I got a shout from someone else who had probably heard what was happening from Palace and said, you know, don't sign for them. We're Terry Venables is the manager. We want you to come here in the summer. So I went down for talks. There was a car waiting for me to take me to Brighton. I met Peter Taylor in the Metropole. He was watching the football that was on the Tuesday night. And we had talks. They were playing Shrewsbury Town. Brighton were playing Shrewsbury the next night at the Goldstone. Got beat 4-0. I had to get my wife down now because she knew nothing about it till she could come down on the Wednesday. And then we had talks, L talks again on the Thursday morning. And I signed, and it was a fantastic move for me.
Excellent. It's funny, isn't it? In those eras, we were talking about Gordon Smith briefly off air before we started recording, and he was telling a story, I think something about how his transfer was coming about. It did seem that, you know, you were just very much the commodities. You're going to, like, we've made this deal, you're going. That seemed to be the sort of the thrust of it, the way that it was presented to players by the owning club, so to speak. Would that be the case, do you think?
Well, he just said to me that the fee was £30,000. The club needed the money. The chairman had insisted that I go because the bank were wanting, you know, some money. And basically, I had to go. I could have said no, couldn't I? I mean, at the end of the day, it was my decision. And we're talking now on deadline day morning. That's when we're having the next conversation. So I'd only got till the afternoon to say yes or no. And obviously, I knew about playing for Brighton. But some people said to me, why are you going down now? Why? And I used to love playing at the Goldstone when I was at Port Vale because there was always, you know, bigger gates than what we had at Port Vale at that time. It would be 15, 16, 18,000, whatever. And I thought, wow, and the pitch was always immaculate and I loved playing there. And obviously the place caught my eye and I thought, wow, to live down here as well. As playing football, and it was a fantastic move for me. And you know, obviously, we went on and went to the top division for the first time ever, which we'll probably talk about in a minute. But it was just a fantastic. But Peter Taylor only lasted about 11 games. He went back with Peter Taylor eventually, didn't he? So then Alan comes in. Alan Muller. Alan's only 34. I'd be 27, coming 28. Yeah, 27. So I thought, wow. Well, I'm already coming in. World Cup player, Tottenham, Fulham. God, I thought, oh, my days could be numbered here straight away. You know, that happens sometimes. Anyway, he came in and he made the decision that he was retiring and he wasn't going to play again. And he said he saw a lot of himself in me, which was great of him to say. He made me captain, carried on as Peter Taylor, made me captain straight away, which I always enjoyed doing. And obviously the rest is history with Alan, which was fantastic. But the club needed the money at that time, Port Vale. So I had to take that, bear that in mind as well, you know, because I'd had great times there, but it was time for me to move on. I thought I'd done enough and I wanted to go and play, you know, for a bigger and better club.
Andy?
Yeah, I was just going to say, because, I mean, at that time, the other young player that Peter Taylor brought in, obviously, was Peter Ward. So you had this... You know, you had the combination of you and Peter Ward, and then Mullery, I think it is the second season when we're after we missed out. I think we missed out on promotion to the top division. Mark Lawrenson, and then you've got a spine of a team there, haven't you? A really good spine of a team.
Well, you got Fozzie was a good player. Yeah. Mark, two excellent players. Gary Williams, he bought from Preston. Chris Catlin. After Kenny Tyler, who had a lot of experience, myself, Sully. Sully was a good player, Peter O'Sullivan. Mm. He didn't get the recognition he deserved for me. Steve Piper, God bless him. We forged a good pair together. Wardy and Mellor first of all, and then brought Teddy Maybank in, and they had a good partnership. But Wardy was a good player. He was an exceptional finisher. In training, he was exactly the same. Just a little slight guy, wasn't he? You'd look at him and think, nothing there. But the way he'd go by players and his finishing was... And he was like that in training, where his finishing was absolutely first class. That was one thing he always insisted, the gaffer, that we train properly. I know I was talking about Oak Park and the ground track and everything, but the fact that we train properly, you know, he wanted us to be the same. True, and I was the same. If I'm playing an 8v8 or a 10v10, I want to win it. I'm not there just for a mess about on a Tuesday morning or a Thursday morning. So he instilled that into us, to be perfectly truthful.
Yeah. Just on the matter of the signing, just one thing on that was just to explain to anyone that doesn't know, if I'm right, I think there was a March transfer deadline day, wasn't there, as well, and you signed on the last day of that window in March of 76. Yeah, and yeah. I'm certainly glad you did sign. You've gone on to be a legend. I started supporting 79-80. You could call me a glory hunter on that basis. My first memories, you know, it's I was 8 years old at the time, so I don't remember too much about the intricacies of the actual games and, you know, the dynamics and the tactics and all that sort of stuff. But it's about the personalities, the charisma of the players on the pitch. And the people that stood out for me were two of the people you just mentioned there, Peter Ward and Sully, and yourself. And it was a really happy time for me, certainly growing up. And I know, Andy, you're roughly in the same era. You probably, both of you might remember these books as well. I'll just hold them up for the camera. So we got some Up, Up and Away, which was the catalogue of the promotion season, which is my first Brighton book. And here was my second one, Super Seagulls, which this doesn't work well for the audio, obviously, but Brian's having a look. I'm sure. Have you got a copy of those books as well, Brian?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have got copies. Yeah. I've got a photograph in my hall, and it's with me having just scored, and that the stand there that you show with all the fans there, the open and see that full like that, you know, it just brings, and it's in my hall, so every day I walk past it, it brings back unbelievable memory. Because we've took because they said it wasn't a football town, and we took it to 34,000 people. 34,000 that we got promotion from the old third division, beat Sheffield Wednesday. 30,000 on there, and it was not a football town. And then obviously, you know, with the games in, then we get promotion from the third to the second and missing out, and then going to the top league and getting, you know, your Liverpools, your Arsenals, Tottenhams to come to Goldstone. They were incredible days. Incredible.
Yeah. I mean, two things you just mentioned, I'll come to you in a second, Andy. Sorry, I was going to say, one thing is you mentioned about people always asking, if you're an outsider to Brighton, why do you want to go down to Brighton? And often this is mentioned, that it was a really good place to play football. Lots of people of the same generation have said that they enjoyed playing there. You know, that was one of the answers, and obviously the town itself, once they got to know it. And the other thing is, there does seem to be a genuine ongoing underestimation of us as a football town. You mentioned it being sort of described as not being a football town, and then you get there and realise it is. Clough was, I think, saying something similar, wasn't he, back in the day? And it seems to be a recurring theme, even almost permeates through to today. There's almost undertones in it when Leeds are trying to sign Ben White and all the Leeds fans were going online. And there were some of the comments where, I know Peter's smiling because he's always having a go at Leeds, so it's my turn now. But no, there's sort of, even then, there's sort of like an undercurrent of almost this, oh, you're not a proper club. And I know Leeds is a bigger club than Brighton, but there's almost a bit more than just that. There's a bit more of, that's not a proper football place, come up to Leeds. And it's interesting that perception persists through the years to some degree.
I think it's because it's like, you know, obviously, touristy place, the seaside place, you know, miles from anywhere apart from the London thing, isn't it? So, but
and there's the non-industrial element, isn't there? I think that feeds into it for sure. The non-industrial element.
Yeah. I mean, when we all left at that particular time, when the gaffer, you know, left, we were having an argument with Mike Bamber about Sully Mark, and then Mark goes, I went, John Gregory went, Sully went, and they broke up a good team. You know, we just stayed up where we had to win our last four games to stay up, which is part of the process, isn't it? You got up and then you had to fight for a couple of years to establish yourself, and I thought we were doing that. The gaffer was bringing some really good players in. Mike Bamber was allowing him to spend quite a lot of money on players. You know, my 30 grand had gone way up to lots more higher fees, and it was sad the way it ended, really, you know, from our point of view, because we never saw that coming, if you like. We won those four games to stay up, and we thought, oh, next season, you know, we got this again, and bang, all of a sudden, the gaffer goes and it's broken up, you know, shame. But I mean, Sully went to Fulham, John Gregory went to QPR, I went to Luton, Mark went to Liverpool. That was a big one, that the gaffer wanted him to go to Man United and get a couple of players from Man United. And the story went that Mike Bamber obviously wanted the money that I think it was 900 grand, wasn't it? That I think Mark went for. But he was always going to be a top player. He'll speak to Mark and Fozzie and Teddy Maybank and a lot of other players. I still speak to them today. You know, it's a place where I have fantastic memories. And I could have lived there for the rest of my life if that hadn't have happened. And I often think, should I have kept my house in Oak Park? It was a lovely place to live. But then you've got to move on, haven't you? You know, I went to Luton and then I went to Hull City as manager. So, you know, you can't always live somewhere where you're miles and miles away.
Yeah. It would have certainly been worth hanging on to it with today's prices, Brian. Must be worth a fortune
funny enough, I looked, I go through all the websites, my old club, and I'm looking at Brighton, and I just clicked onto properties in Hove, and I wish I hadn't done it.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean,
things happening with the current promoted team today as well. I mean, a lot of the ones who took us up are leaving now, especially since Hewton's gone and players are leaving. And, you know, while I mean, I think you do need to do it to progress, it does leave it. There's a bit something lost, I feel, as well, losing the likes of, you know, Knockhart and Stevens and players who were key to promotion, and Murray as well, you know, all kind of going. And, you know, and even the ones who played the first season, like Ryan and Grosh, and that aren't guaranteed first team places now.
It moves on. One quick question. I want to go back to Andy. Sorry, I didn't come back to you just now, Andy. But one other question while we're talking about when you left, Brian. We did have a question from one of our friends who's actually one of those guys in Manchester, funnily enough, Alistair Jones, who's an Albion fan. And he asked us to ask you, does he think that if he'd stayed with us beyond 1981, could we have avoided relegation in 83? And what does he think we need to do to avoid the same fate this season as well, he asked. But in terms of the first part of that question, it's almost, if you say yes to that, it sounds a bit setting you up to be a big head, doesn't it? But honestly speaking, say if you and a couple of those others had stayed, do you reckon that could have made the difference, or was it just a case of it naturally evolved into a different team and it was always going to be what it was going to be?
Well, I was very jealous of Voice of the Fusion because I went to cup final, didn't I? You know, so I never played at Wembley. So I would have loved to have played at Wembley. But once Mike Bailey made a decision that he was splitting it up and getting his own players in, then there's nothing you can do. I went to that final. And quick story, I went with Peter Sutterby and Maureen Nolan, who was going out with the time. And I went with my wife and we met them up in London. And we walked into the pub just outside Wembley. And it was absolutely rammed with Brighton fans. And it all went quiet. And I thought, oh, they've spotted me coming in. And it wasn't they spotted me, they spotted Maureen Nolan. And it was obviously a great game. And obviously it always goes back to Smudger having a chance on the last kick of the game, wasn't it? Normally Michael Robinson, again, God bless him, Robbo never normally would have passed in that situation. And I think that caught him unawares a little bit, but obviously, the replay went against them. Man United were a good side. But I would have liked to play in that game. But then we got promotion in my first year at Luton. Had a good side. And unfortunately, I was in the Luton side that beat Brighton twice and they went down. So that didn't give me great satisfaction, to be perfectly truthful. But, you know, it's what happens. And the 3 years under David Pleat at Luton were absolutely first class. And I learned a lot of former managers when Gordon Lee took me into Port Vale. Because of how he'd had to manage Freeze and non-league players. Alan Mullery, the way he was, and I've said this to him many times, Gaffer, he wouldn't be able to manage today because he was so hard, he wanted more and driven, and, you know, he would just go berserk if he lost, and that's gone by now. And then I went with David Pleat and he learned me another way of his coaching techniques and stuff like that. So, again, three great times at Port Vale, Brighton and Hull. So sometimes you have to do those and you learn off different people. So I've always had this attitude. I never look back, never, ever look back and think, you know, I shouldn't have done that. I shouldn't have done that. I did it and it's all worked out great for me. So I've always had that mentality, you know.
Excellent. Andy, sorry, yes, I'll finally let you back into the into the chat there. Sorry about that. Go ahead, yeah.
I was just going to say that, I mean, I was looking at your the pictures that no one else can see. And so I would have been there, Brian, out on the East Terrace in 76, 77. I started watching 75, 76, but really 76, 77, I was on it. I was there with my dad's mates. I was 9, 10 years old. And my little blue stool on the terrace, you know, they were, we get, like you say, 33,000 for the big game. I don't know if you've ever seen author Spencer Vignes. He wrote the book Bloody Southerners, which is a quote from Cluffy. But actually, he thinks that the sort of the transformation of Brighton from this kind of backwater football club into something a bit bigger and a bit more meaningful started off with the Cluffy Taylor era, which obviously then was taken on by Mullery, and you were very much part of. And one of the things that always used to strike me about you, because I don't normally get awestruck by talking to ex-footballers, but you are, as a child, you were one of my heroes. You know, I would, when you were in the team, which was most of the time, because probably like me, you like to play football, which kind of leaves me confused sometimes with one or two players today. They don't seem to want to play. They just want to get paid. But there'd be some games, you know, like we needed a bit of a kick up the backside, and you'd be there and you just have your fist out, you know, come on, let's get going. You know, and you get a sense of you as a leader, and that you were someone that people could, I mean, obviously there were other personalities, but someone who could really, we could build the team around, you know. And I followed the team always at home. Sometimes I got to go away, luckily, because my dad would go. And still, for me, my greatest day ever as a Brighton fan was watching you beat Newcastle 3-1 when we got promoted. I mean, that's always stuck in my memory, that day. And beforehand, we were all a bit tense about, you know, we're going to win this, what else could happen, you know. And then we're 3-0 up and no one cares anymore because we're strolling it, you know. They were all great memories for me, great, great memories. And I don't know, but it must be lovely being a professional footballer, knowing that you gave people those memories as well as lived them yourself.
Well, that goal, someone sent it on a Twitter thing, and I can watch it nearly every day, that goal. And I do most days. If I'm looking through it, I'll just press it, and shows that we'd have two or three corners on the spin. Gary Williams took one from that side, took one. And that's when I thought, I'm going in on this one. And obviously it worked. And then to go 3-0 up at half time was fantastic. But that day, everybody says to me what was probably the best day, the best moment. And I always say that moment was probably one of the best in my career. Although I had promotions at my first year at Luton, my first year as a manager at Hull, that goal was probably the biggest highlight.
Yeah. Okay.
I was going to go
because when we spoke to Gordon Smith, and actually, funnily enough, he said the same about Robbo, God rest his soul, that he was shocked that he passed it to him. But what was also really interesting when we spoke to him was that, talking about regrets, is that he said at the time during his career he didn't really think about that missed opportunity. He just played his career. But since he's finished playing football, he said that it's one of the few regrets that he has in football, that he didn't score and he couldn't give us the FA Cup final. So, you know, I was a bit surprised when he said that. I thought he would have just sort of said, you know, that's just how it was, you know, and you move on. But you could see he still felt that loss, really.
I think it's because he's brought up so many times, isn't it? And every time I see him, he was my neighbour behind, we're talking about in Oak Park, he was my neighbour behind him. We used to walk together a lot to training. And I still kept in touch with him loosely. And I know, and he was a good finisher. He was a very, very good finisher, Smudge. And I bet he would say that he never expected Robbo to, but well, he just said it. And I think that was it. But, and had they scored that time, then again in history, the Brighton have won the FA Cup, and then the replay, which I didn't go to, they got murdered, didn't they, in the second?
Yeah, we did. Yeah.
So, Les, can I just talk? Because I'm going to have to put my phone on charge because it's getting quite low. Can I do that?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, no problem. Yeah.
I might just have to sit somewhere else. Let me just plug it in. Oh, I think it'll probably go over to where I was.
One thing I was going to say, Russ, when Brian comes back, there was a couple of things, actually. One was his relationship with David Pleat, because I'm sure I've heard Brian say that he used to phone David Pleat every Sunday morning just to talk about football. And the other one was around Brian when he started to think about becoming a manager, because I'm sure, if my memory's correct, for a while he managed a pub team in Brighton on a Sunday morning pub team. I'm sure I saw him there one day managing that when he was still playing for the Albion. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, hopefully we'll be able to get Brian. I think Brian's coming back in a second.
I'm back now. Yeah, I'm back. I've just moved. You can see where's the one
of my
that's the one at the Albion in front of
marvellous.
Yeah.
So I've got an array of photos on the wall we're looking at here in the background. So it's all good. All good.
Got my boot and brace and my whole days. Yeah, this is my trophy.
Because you went on, we should mention, you went on to play for 3 years, I think, for Luton, wasn't it? 81 to 84. And then on to Hull for playing and managing, wasn't it? Which is where the management career started. But just going back to Andy, you were going to just ask Brian. I don't know if you caught what he was saying just now, but if not, do you want to relay that again, Andy?
So the first thing was, I'm sure I've got a childhood memory of actually when you were still playing for Brighton that you used to manage a Sunday football team.
I did. I managed West Dean. Bought my first house up by the windmill up there, and they knocked on my door one day, and it was two lads, probably about 20, 21, saying, "Would you come and coach us? We train at the With Dean." On the main pitch, by the way, they trained on there.
Yeah.
We saw Steve Ovett. He would be going around the track.
Yeah.
A lot of athletes would. And eventually they said to me, would you come and take us on a Sunday morning? I'll pick the team and stuff like that. So I did that. And we actually won a Sunday. It's my first ever trophy as a manager. We won one of the cups, Sunday cups. And we actually played at the Dripping Pan at Lewis. Yeah. And we all got merrily drunk after the game, and it was a big celebration. And they were good to work with. They were good kids, and just quick kids. 2021. I couldn't go every Sunday because obviously we played up north. I used to stay up north after games. But when I could make it, but I trained them every Thursday night, and it was my first sort of start into coaching. And I was doing my coaching badges, starting my badges down in when I was at Brighton. So it was good to work with them.
So it's quite a good basis.
Do you remember John Vinicum, the reporter?
Yeah.
John was president of that team. And I used to get stick off the lads because he'd give me man of the match, and he'd say, the lads would slow to me saying, you only get a man of the match because he's your gaffer for the Sunday team at West Dean.
And the other thing I've heard you say before, I mean, obviously you've just mentioned David Pleat, and clearly he was quite a significant influence on your career. And I'm sure you said as well that you used to like phone him up every Sunday morning for a chat and just talk about football.
Meet him every week now, and always
even now, yeah.
Even now, speak to Ken Craggs every week. I spoke to Alan Moore last week, and I keep in touch with him because they're such special people to me. You know, the fact that they had such a major part in my playing days. David was a great coach. He's not too well at the moment, but he just loves his football, and the things I learnt off him were a different class. You know, he was great to work with, and obviously promotion the first year. And I never got a medal. We got two promotions at Brighton. We never actually finished top. We should have finished top when we were in the old third division because we were the best side. But we were up, and we almost stopped playing because we were up, and which happens. I think Phil won it, and we should have won it. But when I went to Luton, we won the championship by miles. We were the best. Obviously, went up to the top division. And similar, we had to go to Man City on that last Saturday and win the game. City, and we had to, and David skipped across the pitch and kissed me on the cheek, and he said, "Any way you want." I said, "No, gaffer, my contract's out."
That really is an iconic image, isn't it? Him running across that pitch. Yeah.
He's more like, I'm not running. He was more like bouncing, wasn't he? Arms going, you know, jacket going.
He gets embarrassed about it.
he gets embarrassed about his about the suit and the shoes that he had. And this is again true. The shoes he had were like a light brown tan pair. Myself and Raddy Antich, who scored a goal that day, and Raddy, and he skipped across the pitch in that suit and shoes, and he was embarrassed. And myself and Raddy and David were doing a Q&A at Luton for Trevor, and we'd actually bought, he moved house, he'd actually bought the shoes to that night, and he auctioned them, and a young girl paid a few grand for them, and he gave the money to charity. He said he'd found them. So that's a true story that he sold them. But he would get embarrassed about that when he skipped across the pitch and did that.
That's brilliant. Yeah, it's an iconic moment.
And I did, and we stayed up.
Yeah.
It was an iconic moment.
Yeah, and I mean, another one was more not a visual one, just more anecdotal one, is the trip back after we got promoted, Brighton in 79. The train journey back was apparently notorious. Can you tell us quickly about that? I know you probably told this story a number of times before, but
it started. The club had started the Seagull Special, hadn't they, where the fans used to come to games before, prior to that one. And if we won, the gaffer was great. He would throw me a cigar. I had an occasional cigar at that time. He'd throw me a cigar up. We could have a drink, what we wanted to. If we lost, he wouldn't let us have a drink. He could hardly speak. He couldn't smile. This is how the way Alan was with us, and quite right. But that trip back from Newcastle was special, because we went down the Seagull Special with a champagne, and goodness knows what time we got back in Brighton, and the fans were on the platform station at the station, and we went out again in Brighton, and then had a celebration around the town the next day on the open top bus, and it was just incredible days. And brilliant. Again, the team spirit we had down there, and it started from Mike Bamber and the directors, where they used to travel on the team coach with us, Harry Bloom, Dudley Sizen's chairman, Mr. Appleby, and they would sit down the front playing cards, and we'd be at the back, and they would travel with us, and they'd go abroad with us if we went on a trip, and it was almost like a part of, you know, a great big team. It wasn't just a football team, it was a team off the field as well, you know, with all the directors and the staff. So just unbelievable days. But it was, we used to call it the Paralytic Express, and it certainly was that night.
Yeah, just to further embellish this, so you, on the train journey, you guys were going along the carriage, meeting up with all the fans up and down the train, sharing out champagne and singing songs and all that sort of thing.
Yeah. Excellent. Yeah, we were. Yeah, I don't know who's supplying the booze, but it was just never ending from the time we got on from Newcastle to Brighton. It was just, and like they say, the next day with the celebrations around Brighton and Hove and the surrounding areas was incredible.
Yeah, well, you would have loved the ones when we got back into the top flight in recent times. There was some crowd surging along the train by some of the players going into town from Falmer, apparently. I'd unfortunately already gone into town and missed that one, but I think a couple of the players were surging along, being passed along the carriage by supporters, which is great as well. But not quite in the same class as the Newcastle trip.
No, because that was the first time Brighton had ever been there, wasn't it? So to be a part of that, and for me to captain that was, it obviously was a special time of my life. And it hurt me to leave Brighton. I didn't want to leave. But he made his mind up that he wanted Tony Grealish, and I was part of the thing, because David Pleat had asked about my position. So the move came off, but I would have, you know, happily spent the rest of my days in my football career at Brighton.
Yeah, that's great to hear. And also, I mean, just to say on a final note on the Albion playing career side of things, when you came in and you were installed as captain pretty much immediately, weren't you? You had two promotions in the first 3 years there that we've just been talking about. And I think you were in the PFA player team of the season for at least one of those two promotion seasons. Both of them. Yeah. Sorry, Brian. Yeah. For both of those, yeah.
And at Luton, I got one at Luton as well.
So and I got one at Luton as well. Brilliant.
We actually got the medal for winning the championship. So, as I said before, we should have done that, Brian, because we had such a good side. We're the best side, particularly in Division Three.
Yeah, and thoroughly well deserved, I'm sure. It's just superb time for us, and obviously, you know, it was a happy marriage, wasn't it? I think, because as you said, you enjoyed your time with us. We certainly enjoyed having you with us for that period.
The other one that gave me great pride really is when I got Player of the Season. I think Wardy scored nearly 40 goals that year, and I think I'd got double figures. So that gave me great satisfaction. Not that it was all about me, but it was just a nice thing to receive off the fans. And I've got a photograph of Mike Bamber actually presenting me with a trophy before one of the home games. With a trophy of Player of the Season. But
I was just going to say, it's testament to how well you played that you won the Player of the Season in the year when a striker scored 36 goals. That's to win over him in that season. Really, it's pretty impressive going, isn't it? I'm sure Peter was delighted.
Yeah. I made him aware of it many, many times. Don't worry about that one. Going back to Alan Muller at that time, though, he used to say to me, if you make a decision out there, and I want you to make decisions, I will back you 100%. So if I had to make a tactical change, say we're getting out nobody midfield, and I had to pull somebody in, he would back me 100% in it. And I, as I said, I was like that in training. I wanted to win every game. The players knew I was like that. And I would take it back if I'd just given the ball away. You know, I'd let somebody know. If Wardy, you know, give the ball away too simple, I'd let him know. And vice versa. If I gave it away too simply, then I'd want them to let me know. And I think that's gone out of the game a little bit at the moment. You know, in my opinion, it has, where you're just demanding things of your teammates, aren't you? And you're only doing it to make it better. You're not having to go to make it worse. Or if you did, and you know a player couldn't take that, then you wouldn't do it, would you? You know, some players that you've played with can't actually take that, can they? They're not made that way. So he gave me carte blanche to be, you know, captain on the pitch, to be fair.
Yeah. And just a couple of other questions from me. One is, I've always wondered about the nickname, because you're known as Nobby Horton, aren't you? There's also Mr. Styles, of course, had the same nickname. Where does that come from? And when did you start getting known by that?
Well, that's exactly where it came from. And saddened by him, and I met him many times and played against him when he went to Preston, Nobby Styles. Mm. And what happened was, when I'd gone from Hensford to Port Vale, and he said it was the transfer was a pint of shandy, if you read my book, and it tells you about it. But when we went back, so the fee was actually that we went back, Gordon Lee, who was from Hensford as well, we went back Port Vale to play Hensford in a game, and they kept the gate receipts. But when I was at Hensford, that they used to call me Nobby and said, "Oh, you play like Nobby Stars. You get stuck in, and you're that type of person." And when we went back to play that game with Port Vale, somebody actually just said, "Hey, Nobby," and bang! From that moment, that nickname stuck for the rest of my life, which I'm proud about. Yeah, you know, to be named after somebody like that, and it just stuck, and that's what everybody calls me everywhere I go now. So that because of the Nobby Styles thing, that's basically where it came from.
And that ties in with the other question, actually, I was about to ask, which was, how would you describe yourself as a player? You sort of partially touched on it there by getting stuck in, because to me, as I mentioned, I was only 8-9 years old when I first started watching. So those first 2 years with you there, I remember you being a strong presence in the middle. Do remember you getting stuck in, but seeming to have quite a bit of elegance and grace on the ball. Everything seemed to go through you. That's my impression. Would you say that's about it, or was there more to describe as well?
Yeah, it's more, because when I went to Port Vale, he played me wide on the left. So I was playing wide on the left in a 4-4-2, coming in on my right foot and scoring goals. When Peter Taylor signed me at Brighton, he put me in the centre. So I'm playing with Steve Piper mainly, Sully on the left, Toner and Jerry Fell on the right wing in 4-4-2. And I used to just break forward. Steve Piper would be the holding midfield player, and I used to be allowed to go and break on. I wanted to get in the box and go in the box as many times. That's what the gaffer used to say to me, get in the box a dozen times during a game, count them, get in there. And then eventually one will drop for you. So that was my game. Yeah. Hence, I scored quite a lot of goals at Brighton. And then when I went to Luton, David changed my role. I was 31, and he changed my role completely. He made me into the defensive one of three. So we played 4-3-3, and I was the holding midfield player just in front of the back four. So I didn't get as many goals, but I loved the role because you had a lot of the ball. And it changed my career, really, because that's how I played for the 3 years there. And that's how I played when I went to Hull as player manager and we got promotion the first year by playing that role again. And I took it on to some other clubs. I played it when I came to Man City. I played virtually 4-3-3-ish. And so different roles. So they were the basic three roles that I played. Wide left at Port Vale, centre at Brighton, and a holding one of the four in midfield at Luton.
Excellent. Well, I think if we can, we'll take a break there. If you can hang on for a little bit longer, Brian, we'll just go back with a part two and go through a few other elements of your time since playing and also talk about your book. Would you be okay to hang on for that?
Yeah, great. Yeah.
Excellent. Brilliant. Okay, we'll be back in part two coming up.